Hello, and welcome to the second in a series of podcasts to promote the Reintroduction and Rewilding Summit, which will be held on the 10th of April this year. The summit is run by the Birds of Poole Harbour, the charity dedicated to educating people on the stunning variety of bird life in one of the country's most picturesque locations, and the Self-Isolating Bird Club, a virtual space for wildlife watchers and enthusiasts set up by broadcasters Chris Packham and Megan McCubbin. My name is Charlie Moores, and last week I spoke with a team working to bring breeding ospreys to Poole Harbour. Today I'm talking about the White Stork Project with Project Officer Lucy Groves, a conservation biologist based at the world-renowned Rewilding Centre of NEP and who works for one of the White Stork Project partners, the Jersey-based Durrell Wildlife Conservation Trust. The White Stork Project is working to establish a breeding population of the magnificent white stork in southeast England. And over the next 40 minutes or so, Lucy and I will discuss the hows and the whys of setting this population up, how Lucy found her dream job right on her own doorstep, how even the project team were taken by surprise when the storks nested for the very first time in May 2020, and how charismatic and highly visible birds like white storks can act as flagship species, capturing the imaginations and the hearts of people who have never really looked at birds before. First, though, Lucy gave me an overview of the White Stork Project itself.
So the White Stork Project is a partnership of private landowners and nature conservation organisations who are aiming to restore a population of white storks to the southeast of England by 2030.
Oh, so we've got another 10 years yet.
Yes, it's still very, very early days. The storks they've kind of run away with it and surprised us quite early on. But yeah, it's a long project.
I realise that from your social media feeds. They kind of did catch you by surprise a little bit.
Yes, yeah. They were way ahead of what people told us they would do. It was the typical animals have read the rule books and have thought, no, we're not going to do it like that. We're going to do it like this. So, yeah, they've kind of done their own thing, which is fantastic for us.
And it's such perfect habitat down at NEP as well. So that's probably helped.
Yes, yeah, it is indeed.
Where have your white storks come from? I believe they're from captivity so that there isn't an impact on wild populations.
Yeah, so the majority of our white storks have come from Poland. They've come from Warsaw Zoo. So many of the very early ones are wild storks who were injured. Most of them tend to get injured in their first couple of years. Out there, they hit pylons, electricity pylons. They quite like nesting on top of pylons as
well, which
obviously isn't the wisest of ideas. And they are rehabilitated at Warsaw Zoo. And the project has kind of got a little bit of a complicated different phases for the reintroduction to work. But we originally got our first lot of birds. They are all permanently injured. They have lost bits of wings. Although they are perfectly healthy now, completely rehabilitated, they can't go back to the wild.
Right.
So that's where we sourced those from. And they provide sort of static little populations at our release sites. And then the next batch were rehabilitated storks that could fly. And they, again, have come over. And from now on, all of our storks are actually bred from those original birds, captive stock now, at Cotswold Wildlife Park, who run the breeding programme for the project. So our birds all went to Cotswolds first. They have 30 days quarantine at Cotswolds before they're moved out to any other sites. So we've got three sites down here in the southeast. So we've got NEP, which I call the nucleus of the project. It's the main area.
It's the nucleus of everything.
Yes, I know. Yeah. So it's the main area for the project. It's got the largest enclosure where we've got a static population and we've got the most number of free flying birds around resident around NEP as well.
Right.
We've then got a site in East Sussex, which is at Wadhurst Park. They've got, again, another enclosure with a slightly smaller number of birds than NEP. And then we've got another one just in the south of Surrey, which is, again, a little bit smaller than the other two and a year or so behind the other two. And that provides kind of like this little hub down here in the southeast, which is a perfect spot for it because the birds will be crossing channel from France to Dover. So basically they'll come across the channel and they'll see these static populations at these three sites and think that's a good place to stop. Let's head down over there. So that's kind of the reason behind that.
Yeah. Those are natural vagrants you're talking about, not part of the project yet.
Not yet. But yes, so mainly vagrants at the moment. We get about 20 to 30 wild vagrants every year coming over to the UK, but not stopping to breed. So yeah, the idea with those static populations is it encourages those wild ones to stop and stay and perhaps set up a pair with any of our birds. But also now that we're doing releases and our birds are migrating south, they've got a good spot to cross the channel right from where we are, but also when they return, when they come to breeding age again, they'll cross the channel and they'll know exactly where they are.
Yeah, it's really good. It's great, isn't it? One of the difficulties that I've been reading about with rewilding is the need for licenses. You don't require a license, do you? Because as we've said, white storks are natural vagrants to the UK and they did once breed here.
Yeah, so Natural England, we didn't need a licence from Natural England to do the reintroduction and re-establishment of the population. Because we get vagrants every year and because they are historically a breeding bird, and the BTO classify them as a former breeder.
So
we don't actually need a licence from Natural England to do the reintroduction. However, we do have to follow all of the same processes of reintroduction, so the IUCN guidelines.
Yeah, of course you do, yeah. How much easier has it been because you haven't had to use licenses? Because they can be incredibly complex.
Most of the processes that we've had to go through leading up to the reintroduction and the releases is all similar sort of stuff as you'd need to do for the licenses. But the licenses do require a lot of background work and it can take quite a lot of time to get these things pushed through. There's a lot of box ticking and making sure that everything is all in line and that everybody is happy with what's going ahead.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've had to, you know, comply with a lot of things along those lines anyway, but it has made it slightly easier without having to get a license to do it yet.
Can I ask you some tricky questions, really, because I hate asking this because I'm a birder. I would love to see white storks in every single field in the UK, and I think it's a really great idea. But why white storks? Because they are classified globally as least concern. You just mentioned the BTO there. There's no conservation status in the UK. And actually, populations now seem to be increasing across Europe, predominantly on the back of reintroductions. If they're not a declining bird, what's the reason for bringing them back?
So there's a few reasons, and yeah, although they're classified as a bird of least concern, as you said in your question, they are increasing in number, and that is on the back of many reintroductions across Europe. So eight other countries across Europe have reintroduced the white stork into their former ranges, and we are one of the last countries to sort of establish them in that former range.
Yeah.
Population numbers are changing constantly with the white storks. They are very adaptable. Their migration behaviours are changing as well. So areas where they would normally leave, they're staying, and lots of things are changing and lots of research is being done. So on the back of that, we also wanted to use the white stork as an ambassador or as a flagship you know, nature connection is the biggest one for us. We really, you know, it's about rewilding people as well as rewilding nature and sort of bridging that gap of nature disconnect that we have, especially here in the UK. Those other reintroductions have used them as flagships for wetland creation, habitat restoration, and we are hoping to do that as well on alongside the nature connection side of things. You know, you can only get people involved in nature conservation if they've got strong feelings for it. They want to protect it.
Yeah.
And the stork seems to be this wonderful ambassador for that. People have just absolutely loved them. You've only got to look at the reactions we had throughout last year when we had the chicks. Yeah, people just absolutely loved them.
The chicks are not the prettiest birds in the world, are they?
No, they're not. They're not the prettiest. I tend to think that about quite a lot of bird chicks. They're not exactly particularly good looking. We had people coming to NEP who had never seen a stork before, didn't know that they didn't live in the UK, but were completely blown away by these massive birds in the top of a big oak tree.
Yeah.
We had over 30,000 visitors coming to see the storks alone during the summer, which was unbelievable.
Last year?
Yes, yeah. So once lockdown had lifted, people were able to get out and explore. We had a completely different demographic of people visiting NEP and getting engaged and talking to us about the storks. And it just completely blew us away with the amount of people we had talking and visiting and just absolutely loving the storks.
That concept of rewilding people, that's a really great idea, actually. It's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, we're always talking. Yeah, we're always talking about rewilding landscapes and ecosystems. But we also need to look at ourselves as well. And yeah, you have to connect to nature, you know, especially younger people as well. You get them involved now. They're the ones that are going to be looking after it for years to come. And that really has to happen. And that's another thing that we're looking at. We're looking at securing funding at the moment to actually develop a stork schools program so that we can connect with local schools around the release sites, talk to them about ecosystems, about migration, about behavior, about movement ecology, about all of this really important stuff, and get them connected to it so that they can help look after it going forwards.
That's an idea that works extremely well abroad, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
From Africa to Asia, if you can get the local school children interested in it, you've got a much higher chance of those birds still being there in 5 years' time.
Exactly. And there's a lot of research behind, you know, once children get connected, they actually change the thoughts and behaviours of their parents, which, you know, is amazing. You know, your kid starts to get into something, so you start to learn about it as well. And it just has that massive knock-on effect, which is absolutely amazing. And, you know, hopefully we can engage with schools across Europe as well, like link schools up together, talking about how they're moving through the landscape across, you know, continents and countries. You know, they connect us through their journeys, which, you know, in my mind, just be absolutely amazing for a child in a school here in Chipley Village talking to somebody, you know, in Portugal or Spain or even Morocco, where absolutely one of our storks may have gone to. So, yeah.
That's a very well-established concept, isn't it? With towns being twinned for various cultural reasons. But doing it for storks would be fantastic. I think the same thing happens, always beginning to happen with things like ospreys as well, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, there's a lot of work going on with the ospreys, and it's a huge inspiration and stuff that, you know, we can do with the Stork Project as well going forwards.
You've taken me completely off track here, which is
great. I get onto something else by talking about
it. Absolutely, that's the way conversation should go. I did want to ask, actually, because you mentioned about flocks of storks coming over from France, from the near continent. The UK is actually right on the western edge of the breeding range. Could storks have arrived naturally as the climate warms anyway? Because that's happening with a lot of, particularly herons and egrets.
We're getting more and more vagrants every year to the UK of white storks from the continent. But because those breeding colonies have been lost, they're not staying to breed. And it's unlikely that they would without a little bit of help. So it's similar to, as you were discussing with the ospreys, they imprint on their natal area.
Right.
So they will return to where they have hatched or where they've been raised and breed themselves once they reach sexual maturity. So again, that is kind of the thought behind it. We're, you know, okay, they're hatching at Cotswolds, the majority of the ones that we're releasing. But similar to the ospreys, they spend 2 or 3 weeks with us here at NEP. They get used to the area. They get used to the other adults that we've got around. They know where to feed. They know it's a good spot. And then they're all migrating together. And that should cause them, when they return, to come back to those same areas and breed themselves.
Right. Just to prove I was listening to the osprey guys, that's called natal phylopatry, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. So I learn through these podcasts as well, which is massively important. In the feasibility study for this project, it was said that it's likely that a combination of habitat loss, overhunting and targeted persecution all contributed to their decline. I appreciate that was also in the UK, But have those factors been removed on the non-breeding grounds in Africa, where actually the storks are spending at least half their time?
So here in the UK, a lot of those previous challenges have been reduced. You know, wetlands are being restored, and changes are being made to farming practices. And hopefully, with changing in the farming schemes and that coming up over the next couple of years, that will improve even more. But sadly, they do still face the same sort of threats on their migration routes and in their overwintering grounds. Yeah, juvenile white storks have actually a 70% mortality rate on their migration.
Oh, which is the same as the ospreys.
Yeah. It's that's the same. It's due to, you know, persecution, so targeted and illegal and even legal shooting on those migratory routes, but also the same again with the ospreys. It's the weather conditions and their inexperience as well. But it's quite difficult to, from here, you know, very early on in our project, to make changes to those overwintering grounds. And all we can do is help, you know, bolster those populations at the moment, and hoping that many of ours that are being released over the years will return to the UK and perhaps bring some wild ones back with them. But yeah, there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done on migratory routes for all of our bird species.
Yeah, it sure is. You mentioned earlier on that some birds are now staying within Europe. They've been adapting to landfills, haven't they?
They have, yes. I kind of liken them to large gulls, really. Like landfill sites. They're hugely adaptable in their feeding behaviour, but also their migratory behaviour as well. And lots of research has been done over recent years using GPS tags. And that is something that we at Durrell are bringing to the project. So we've been GPS tagging our storks that we're releasing. And quite a lot of them are using landfill sites on their migratory routes and spending quite a lot of time on those. Normally they would be eating predominantly insects is their main source of food. Earthworms make up about 30% of their diet. Yeah. They'll eat small mammals, they'll eat amphibians, reptiles, fish, you know, they're really, really adaptable. But yeah, landfill sites is one of the key things. The legislation in Europe is changing.
I was going to mention that.
And yeah, at some point, there will not be any organic matter on those landfill sites. And we're working with UEA, the University of East Anglia, uh-huh, with the GPS tagging. And they are actually undertaking quite a lot of studies and modelling to see what might happen to those stork populations once that food source has been removed. It's likely that their migratory patterns will kick back in, their instincts will kick back in. The main driver behind their migration is food availability. So if they've got food, they're going to save that energy. There's no real need to migrate if they've already got that food source where they are. So, you know, they are tending to sort of stay in Central and Southern Europe rather than going all the way down to Morocco or to Southern Africa. They show huge plasticity in their behaviour, changing what they're doing to suit with the circumstances they find themselves in.
Yeah. Lucy, it's difficult to see what objections there might be to this project. Have there been any?
As with most reintroductions, there are a few objections, you know, that there usually are. And actually, quite a few are coming from the same people who are objecting to reintroducing the white-tailed eagles and things like that. The two main points are the query as to whether they were ever actually truly native to the UK, and also concerns over predation on perhaps sensitive species that are here in the UK. The native question, it's not quite as clear cut as some other species, and with a migratory bird, it's quite difficult anyway. But there is enough evidence to suggest that they were regular visitors to the UK and occasional breeders as well. That's what we're going on, and we feel that they should be here.
Absolutely right. You go for it.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the other point, the predation of sensitive species, and as I've already said, their diet is hugely varied, with the vast majority being made up of earthworms and insects. They are highly adaptable, and they will take whatever they find. But their hunting strategy isn't to target particular food or prey items. They stalk through grassland or wandering around wetlands and basically kicking up stuff as they go. So if they disturb something or if they flush something from the grassland, say a vole, they'll have a peck at it and that's what they'll end up eating. Or they'll be picking up all of the insects as they go. Or, you know, if they manage to catch a fish, they'll do that. They're not quite the same as, you know, like a heron who would be specifically hunting for fish within a pond or things like that. So we do not feel that they would actually target a particular species to the point where they would make a huge impact on their population.
I noticed in the feasibility study that there was some suggestion that pheasant poults were taking. And there were plenty of shoots down your way. Have you had any issue with the shooting clubs?
No, we've had absolutely no issue at all. And the thing with the pheasant poults and stuff is that the rearing pens are generally in woodland, which is not a habitat that the storks would use anyway. They tend to avoid wooded areas.
Yeah, they're much more open, aren't they?
Much more open habitat. So grassland, wetland, floodplains, areas that are periodically flooded. So although they may occasionally take the chicks of other bird species, it is not a massive part of their diet. It's a very small percentage of their diet. So we don't have any problems, no.
How did you get involved, Lucy? I did read about you that you're more into small mammals than birds, but you sound, I can't fault you on this, you sound like you're really excited about the white storks.
I am really excited about the white storks, but yeah, predominantly my speciality is small mammals and in particular harvest mice. So I used to be a zookeeper at a collection that specialised in British wildlife, and we predominantly had mammals, although we did have owl and bird of prey species. So I'm just passionate about all wildlife, really. So I wouldn't class myself as a birder, but I am more of a keen naturalist, and like anything to do with the natural world. But yeah, so I left my job at the zoo in 2017 and started, I started as a freelance conservation biologist.
Yeah, I read that. That's very brave of you.
Yes.
There's an awful lot of competition out there for not that many jobs.
Yeah, I know. It was one of those decisions. I think I'd learned what I could at where I was. There wasn't a lot of professional development or progression. And I had done loads of volunteering and lots of extra work whilst I was there as a keeper. Did a lot of outside of my normal work. And just felt that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be actually out in the field doing practical conservation and, you know, actually being out with wild animals as much as I loved working at the zoo and getting that close contact. And yeah, so I'd already made quite a lot of contacts with people in the local area. Very lucky here in Sussex. We've got a fantastic conservation sort of community. And I'd already got my name known within that community, which was really, really worthwhile doing. And when I left the zoo, I had quite a few people say to me, oh, well, you can come and do these surveys and we'll pay you to do this and that. And I decided, right, well, that's it. I'm just going to go freelance and do that. And I started doing safaris. I'm a safari guide at the Net Rewilding Project.
Oh, that's how you got
there. I absolutely love. Yeah. Wow. So, and I'd been doing that for about a year and a half, 2 years when they were looking for somebody to help look after the storks actually on the site. So obviously my zookeeping side came in. And then that was roughly about the same time that Durrell got involved with the project, and they wanted someone who could also undertake some of the research, but also the public engagement side of things. And whilst I'd been at the zoo, I'd been doing all of those things, and I kind of just fitted the bill, really, and fitted straight in.
It just shows, doesn't it? You never know what you've done in the past, how that's going to help you in the future. You've just got to try everything, just have a go.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I was quite unique as I had all of the, you know, the practical keeping husbandry of captive species, but also working out in the field doing surveys and research and writing reports and undertaking studies, as well as all of the public engagement I was doing as well. So
that's fantastic.
It all slotted together. Basically.
This isn't a typical project for the Doral Wildlife Conservation Trust, is it?
It is a slightly different project for them, but their new strategy, their new five-year strategy is called Rewild Our World. And they are aiming for a wilder, healthier and more colourful world. And although saving species from extinction is still right at the heart of what Doral do, they have big ambitions for going beyond that. And they want to use their expertise to help rewild ecosystems so that they can be more functional and diverse and resilient. But also they want to improve the quality of people's lives as well. And a huge part of their work is now reconnecting people with nature and driving societal change, which is what we need to help restore our world. And they want to see, by 2025, they want to see 1 million people better connected with nature. And that's kind of where
that's
this
ambitious.
Project fits in. It's really ambitious. Yeah, really.
That's really far-sighted as well. It's not something I would have normally, you know, if you said to me who came up with this idea, I probably wouldn't have said Doral.
Yeah, I know, it's fantastic.
Fair,
but... And Doral, I absolutely love working for Doral. When I was a zookeeper, it was always something to aspire to work for Doral. And it always seemed completely out of reach because I put them on a pedestal. But you know, through what I've done, I've ended up working for them. And they're an amazing organisation to work for. The way they look at things and the way they join things up is just amazing. They really, really want to help the communities that they're working in, as well as the species that they're trying to save. A lot of it is to do with the sort of the social science side, as well as the actual saving species from extinction and looking at how ecosystems work. So it's really, really important to them that we're involved with this project. And it's actually their first project in the UK as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because the ones I know particularly bad, the Madagascar pochard, the lemurs in Madagascar, Mauritius, where they brought the kestrel and echo parakeet they've worked on. All around the world. I'd never thought of them as the UK, apart from Choughs, that they're helping to reintroduce into the Channel Islands.
I mean, we joined the project, the already established project partnership in 2018. And the idea was to bring Doral's skill set of reintroductions, hands-on management, post-release monitoring to this project in the UK, and there will be more projects coming up in the UK as well that Doral will be involved with. So it's really, they just decided that actually, do you know what, we need to be doing something on home turf as well as all of these far-flung countries and that need our help. So yeah, it's a fantastic project and organization to be working with.
Can I ask you what it's like working at NEP? I haven't been yet. I don't know why. And of course, now I'm really fascinated and dying to get down there and can't because of the lockdown. Is it as good as I think it is?
It's really, really lovely. I can't say anything
better
other than that, really. But it's a wonderful place to be. I was very, very lucky that actually for 7 years it was on my doorstep, basically.
Right.
It was my playground, just going for lots of walks and things like that. But we're actually working there, being a safari guide and now working with the Stork Project. It's amazing to kind of be immersed in such a wonderful habitat and surrounded by so many passionate people all, you know, we're all on the same page, but we all have our own little specialities. We're all good at different things. And that's one of the things I love with NEP. You could do three safaris in three separate days with three different safari guides and you'll get a different take on each of the little areas. And we've all got our own specialities. And it's just a beautiful landscape. For me, it just feels like the land has just sighed and sort of gone, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right,
it's just really, really lovely. Just the scrub and the natural processes that are happening, you know, the free roaming livestock. And if you want NEP at its best, go and have a walk around for the Dawn Chorus in May. That is just outstanding.
Oh, I just can imagine the... Hearing the nightingales alone would be enough.
Yeah, it is absolutely stunning. Yeah, it's amazing.
And how are you handling the media side of things? You're quite in demand at the moment.
Yeah, it's not something I thought I'd ever really sort of be involved with, but it's definitely a skill that I've had to pick up. I started the job in April 2019,
yeah.
And a week after I started, BBC Springwatch turned up, and I had to learn a lot about storks very, very quickly. And it's amazing, though. Yeah, exactly. Straight in at the deep end. But it's been really great, actually. And I love being able to talk about the storks. I'm obviously quite passionate about the project.
You certainly are. You come across as very passionate about it. Yeah.
I try to be. It's just one of those things. I think if you love what you do, it's easy to talk about it. And to be able to share it with people it has just been fantastic. And I think last year in particular, you know, what was happening at NEP during sort of March and April with the nesting and the chicks, it was all getting very exciting. We were all in lockdown. And luckily, because I lived on the doorstep, I was able to continue as normal as possible. I was able to be out there watching the storks and doing that. Unfortunately, my wonderful group of volunteers weren't allowed out to help.
Right.
So I ended up taking on a lot of the extra work. I couldn't do the project without the wonderful volunteers.
Yeah.
But it was amazing for me to be able to go out, take photos, take videos and share it with people on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and Instagram. And just know that they were bringing a little bit of joy to people whilst they were stuck at home. They were such a positive thing for me and for others to come out of 2020. You know, it was a difficult year, and this year is looking difficult too. But hopefully they'll be able to bring some more joy to the public.
Wow. I do love talking with you. That's great. That's so
thank
cool.
you. We had so many emails from people. You know, I look after all of the email as well and record all the sightings that come in from people. So I collate all the data. But we had birds flying around the UK. We had one up in Yorkshire. We had some down in Cornwall. We had them all over the place. And getting an email from someone who has looked out of their window, or they're doing a bit of birding in their garden because they're on lockdown and they can't get out, who has seen a stork and has just told me that actually it's the best thing that's happened to them all week, or, you know, what a wonderful sight and what a sign of hope they are. It was fantastic. It really makes all of the long hours and that worthwhile.
Yeah, that's great. These are big, bright, obvious looking birds. I mean, they do make a day if you see something like that and you weren't expecting it. I imagine if one turned up in your garden, you might be a bit,
I know,
you might
yeah.
be a bit alarmed. But I mean, fantastic
birds to
see.
They're so big and charismatic. And even if you've never seen a stork before, we know what a stork looks like. We all know storks bring babies. And even in the UK, you know, they're still very much a part of our heritage and our culture, even if we don't think about them all the time. But everybody's seen, you know, that image of the stork carrying a baby. I think that's something that's so amazing. I've spoken to people who have never done a bit of birding in their life, but they've recognised a stork and have emailed and gone, have I just seen one of your storks? And I, you know, can normally piece together the sightings and say, yes, that was so-and-so, and this is where it's been recently. And people just absolutely love that. It's that connection, I think,
yeah.
that...
Which is exactly what you meant by flagship species, because then people, they invariably have to learn a bit more, you know, where did it come from? What kind of habitat? What does it eat?
Exactly. They get so excited by it. They want to know more about it. And that's that connection. That's that bridging, that gap between being disconnected and actually then starting to learn about it. I've also had people send me sightings saying, I've seen one of your storks, and they've added a photo, and it's a heron. But,
well,
you know,
still
these
a
are
good
people
try.
That wouldn't, yeah,
yeah,
people that wouldn't yeah. have been looking before and now looking out of their window and seeing it. And that's a good chance for me to say, well, actually, that's a heron, but this is what a stork's look like, and this is the difference between the two, and this is what they both do, and, you know, this is what they eat, this is where they go, this is the habitat they use. And it still gets people involved, which is amazing.
Thanks so much for this, Lisa. I've really enjoyed it. I'm not sure whether to ask you this final question now, but I was wondering what success would mean for you in terms of the project, your freelance. You're working so hard, you're kind of going to head towards redundancy eventually, aren't you, if the project succeeds? have you thought about what you're going to do and what you do next?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope that the Storks are a success. I hope that what I want to see with the Storks is them breeding every year here in the UK, and I want people to be accepting them into our towns and villages like they do across Europe. I want to see them nesting on people's roofs and people getting excited about it. And as I said, they've been such a positive thing for people throughout lockdown that I think that's so amazing. For me, if I'm not working with the Storks, then I hope to continue working for Durrell, and as well as lots of my other freelance projects that I'm working on. But I hope to work with the Storks for a little while longer, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is the first time I've ever spoken to you, and I already can say that Durrell would be mad to lose you. So,
oh, thank you.
There's a plea from me to Durrell. Employ this person. She's bloody good. Lucy, thank you so much for your time, and the very best of luck. I'll put up all the links and things to the White Stork project.
Well, let me know if you do come down to Neppertal. I'll give you the grand tour.
Oh, I've got your email now. There's absolutely no doubt. I'll be contacting you if I can come down.
That's great. It's been really lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
Lucy Groves, White Stork Project Officer, talking with me from Sussex in early February. There is, of course, much more information on the Storks at whitestorkproject.org. And you can follow the project on Twitter at Project Stork. Lucy herself has a Twitter and Instagram feed at Lucy in the Wild. Thank you very much for listening.